Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled Information Technology, Leadership, and the Future of Higher Education. And our speaker is Irving Blythe, retired Vice President for Information Technology and CIO at Virginia Tech.
Thank you and good afternoon. I very much appreciated the recognition this morning by EDUCAUSE. It's especially humbling to me to be included among so many previously recognized leaders that I have had the honor of knowing and following. To a very real extent, everything that my colleagues and I have accomplished at Virginia Tech over the last 35 years has been built upon the great ideas and accomplishments of those people. I want to start off a little bit light. I also mentioned this morning the importance of my family to my career, but now I want to recognize my wife and true partner in every aspect of my life, Betsy Williams Bly. I met her in 1968 at the Department of Navy. She does not like it when I point out that between us we have 88 years of experience in information technology. Betsy was then and still is a beautiful lady that I, at first glance, tagged as the classic bubbly blonde. I quickly discovered that she was one of the Navy's best machine and assembly language systems program. She was the first Greek geek in my life and the only one that I've ever truly loved. Thank you, Betsy. As I said this morning, the recognition at the end of my long tenure at Virginia Tech CIO especially honors my extraordinary talented and committed colleagues at that university. This recognition is theirs, and it also belongs to the two CIOs that preceded me at our university, Vinod Chhatra and Bob Hederick. To my Virginia Tech colleagues, I also want to say that your great work made it possible to attract and gain the commitment of Scott Midkiff as our new CIO. With your continued commitment, I know that Scott's leadership and contributions to Virginia Tech and higher education over the next few years will be more notable than anything attributed to Vinod, Bob, and me. This recognition is truly special coming from an organization like EDUCAUSE. I have a 44-year commitment to and appreciation for our information technology profession. During that time, I've witnessed the reshaping of our global economy and society as a result of breakthrough innovations in information technology. But we are all also privileged to be part of the education community, supporting the highest of all human endeavors, learning and teaching. Information technology is the DNA of the global education fabric, and leading edge competencies in information technology for those in higher education are critical and strategic to its future. I am among those convinced that the form and organization of higher education, the structure of advanced learning and teaching, will change more over the next 30 years than it has over the last 300. It is EDUCAUSE and the related and spinoff organizations like Internet2 that will be so critical to our profession and through you, so important to helping to shape the future of higher education. With this recognition, I was told that I would be allocated time to address you. I responded, address you about what? And the answer was, I could talk about anything I like. And I can honestly say in my entire career, that's the first time I got that particular direction. One friend told me to talk about my life in information technology, the peaks and valleys of technology innovation, and the future of higher education, and anything else I really cared about. Now, colleagues that really know me, and especially every boss I've had, would tell you that no one exceeds Irv Bly in the ability to take any topic from the most mundane to the most esoteric and talk endlessly about it. Except perhaps for my friend at Internet2, David Lambert. My intention is to leave you with something of value. I promise not to exceed about 30 more minutes. Each of these four, what I call lessons, are the things that stand out most in my life. First, I'm going to take a few minutes and talk about the liberal education roots on which I have built a career in higher education. and information technology. Second, I'm going to talk about a couple of the significant technology shifts that enables extraordinary change in our world and share a couple of thoughts about what's next. Third, I'm going to talk about lessons from the darkest days of my life, the mass murder at Virginia Tech on April 16, 2007, and about future implications and obligations related to safety and security. And last, I'm going to share thoughts about our leadership responsibilities as members of the university community. It is ironic that after a 44-year career, this is my first opportunity to reflect on something quite dear to me, the value of my education in the liberal arts and humanities at Virginia Tech, known at that time as Virginia Polytechnic Institute, or VPI. My father was convinced, for reasons I don't care to share, that I would benefit from attending one of the Commonwealth of Virginia's two military schools, Virginia Military Institute, VMI, or VPI. So one very cold day in January 1963, we visited VMI, and I witnessed several freshmen, while being referred to as rats, at rigid attention, backs against the wall, and then screamed at for various real and imaginary infractions accumulated during the day. Two evenings later, I was walking across the VPI campus and was amazed at the contrast. Virtually every person I met greeted me with a friendly, "Good evening, sir." So for me, the choice was quite easy. It was the friendly and welcoming VPI over the dark and foreboding VMI. Skip forward to late August of 1963 and the end of my first day as a freshman in the then mandatory Corps of Cadets at Virginia Tech. I was, along with fellow freshmen, at rigid attention, back against a wall, and being screamed at by First Lieutenant Jenkins. I don't normally remember names that easily, but his is burned into my memory, I think, for my life. And he said, "And another thing, you rats, when you walk across this campus, you had better greet every individual with good morning, afternoon, or evening, sir or madam, as appropriate." So my first lesson is take more than one sample before you jump to conclusions. I have been asked countless times how my education in the liberal arts prepared me for a career in advanced computer and communications technologies. For example, this question was implied in a query by one of my strongest supporters at Virginia Tech, who also happened to be the dean of the College of Engineering at that time. He was aware that I was taking a couple of graduate courses in electrical and computer engineering as part of the graduate program I was in. So he asked me, "Irv, given your academic background, how is it competing with engineers in your graduate classes?" And I responded, "It's like fishing with dynamite." I will admit that in the 1960s, getting a liberal arts-based education at VPI, primarily an engineering and agricultural-oriented school of just over 4,000, was hard work. It was hard work for me and very hard work for a few extraordinary faculty. For one, a proud Cherokee Indian who used to describe himself as one of the Indians that escaped from the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs, I learned the importance of being very precise in my use of language. With another as a guide, I studied Milton's Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, Samson Agonistes, and Tenure Kings of Magistrates, and learn to analyze and to break down a work to its most basic elements, line by line, word by word. From our resident Shakespeare scholar at Virginia Tech in the 1960s, I learned about the importance of context, of structure, of organization, and of understanding the audience and building a great work. Perhaps the most important, though, was by the end of my undergraduate experience at Virginia Tech, I had discovered that to succeed, I needed to love to learn. I did not know it at the time, but that was the perfect foundation for a career in information technology. In 1968, I was offered a position at the Department of Defense as a management intern, in which I was given the opportunity to explore various career paths in, for instance, public relations, contract negotiations, computing. Three competencies for success in the information technology profession are the ability to analyze, precision in the use of language, and the ability to organize and synthesize. For example, an early lesson in computer languages was that computational machines do it exactly what you tell them to do. Most of the worst debacles in computational systems can be traced back to imprecise, sloppy use of language. The first things I look for in a potential employee, from intern to senior management, are: what have you done? What do you know? And are you hungry to discover and learn? The ability to analyze, the ability to organize and synthesize, and precision in the use of language, all of you have these competencies. But the most important characteristic shared by all of us is that is critical to success in the field of information technology, is a commitment to continuous learning. I am going to talk about a couple of highlights relative to technology shifts, things that I've been able to be close enough to play a role in. For great examples of leadership, we're graced by extraordinary information technology professionals and researchers across the spectrum of higher education. Over my career, I've realized that there's probably no emerging technology, process, concept, or opportunity that isn't being examined and tested somewhere in our community. More important, when the occasional great idea, that potentially disruptive technology, shows promise, there always will be a few early movers in our community willing to coalesce around large-scale proof-of-concept initiatives, and if warranted, aggressive exploitation of that breakthrough. The internet as we know it today, large-scale, highly parallel, high-performance computing, and the open source movement have benefited from, and many may even owe their existence to, this characteristic of our community. It's old news that the internet has transformed our world and our future. It has changed global, national, and local economies. It has decreased the importance of physical distance, but dramatically increased the value of knowledge and human creativity, and of timely, high-capacity access to these resources. To higher education institutions in the early 1990s, the internet opened an array of capabilities and tools. Until that time, the exclusive reserve of a few federally sponsored big science researchers and computer scientists. Arguably, though, through the facilitation of collaboration and of access and sharing of specialized tools and knowledge resources, the internet has significantly broadened and strengthened the role of colleges and universities in basic, applied, and scholarly research. I suspect many of you in this audience take all this for granted, but I remember two incidents that helped me realize how far we've come. The first was a telephone company vice president sitting in my office in 1979 and showing me charts and plots of the rapid rise in terminal to mainframe communications links on our campus, which at that time were provisioned by his company. It showed 10 lines requested in 1975, 15 in 1976, 25 in 1977, 50 in 1978. He said, "This is ridiculous. When is it going to stop?" Today I could tell him the count's over 50,000 and still rising. The second example was over 10 years later when I had a peripheral part in the rollout of NSFNet as the principal investigator for the Virginia component called Virginia Education and Research Network. I was in the office of the president of one of Virginia's small public colleges. He said, "Now, once again, in just a few words, what is this network technology?" I responded that we were exploring the utility of a dramatically different way to link nationwide colleges and universities based upon a significantly different communications technology with potentially extraordinary increased efficiency and lower cost. And he just stared at me and then said, "And what would be its value to this college?" I responded that it might enable faculty and students on this campus to communicate with any faculty and students on other campuses in the U.S. anytime and at a transaction cost approaching zero. He stared at me for the longest 30 seconds and then said, "Now why in the world would I want to do that?" So what is obvious today was not so obvious 20 or 30 years ago. The emergence of ARPANET in the late 1960s, the development of the internet protocols in the 1970s, and the establishment of NSFNet in the late 1980s culminated in the commodity internet that we knew today. Driving NSFNet, we had visionaries in our community, people like Kenneth King and Stuart Lynn, Mike Roberts, Stephen Wolf, Glenn Reichert, and Doug Van Hallen, and many others that recognized the opportunity, that realized the potential extraordinary but unquantifiable benefits of the invention and new concepts developed by university and federally sponsored researchers. And they took great risks to make the nationwide demonstration of this new mode of communications happen. They did not do it for fame and fortune. They did it for community, for our community, to enhance research, discovery, and learning. And to me, those leaders at that time and place exemplify a favorite. This is a paraphrased version of Clausewitz's definition of great leadership. To succeed, two qualities are indispensable: the perception to discover an opportunity which is barely visible, and then the courage to follow this faint light with intense and total resolution. To me, I feel privileged to have known, been able to identify leaders like that in our community over the past 30 years. The second huge leap forward commenced in 2003 when a consortium of United States research universities and private sector providers led by Internet2 began developing a national communications infrastructure based on the most advanced optical communications and network technologies. This initiative reflected the full potential of new and emerging optical communications technologies and is enabling terabit per second networks, reflecting 2 to 3 orders of magnitude improvement in price per unit of bandwidth. The fundamental and overriding goal of that initiative, begun in 2003, was to provide an enabling experimental infrastructure for new forms and methods of science and engineering. But again, we're seeing that the ultimate beneficiaries are woven into our economic and social fabric and accrue to every person in our nation. So what's next in the world of communications and networking? I have a friend that is constantly reminding us it's not about the artifacts, it's about the vision. So what is the vision we're chasing? An ideal electrical communication system can be defined as one that permits any person or machine to reliably and instantaneously communicate with any combination of other people and machines, anywhere, anytime, at zero cost. With these historic words, in 1964, Paul Baran of the RANDUP Corporation established the holy grail of 21st century communications. For the foreseeable future, that's the dream the vision we're going to be chasing. I want to say a little bit about what I call the chase for commodity supercomputing. The National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, and other agencies have funded multi-million dollar projects to develop environments that enable scale computation necessary to model and solve the most complex science and engineering problems. The vision is for computational power which enables the economic engineering of nanoscale assemblies of materials, the design and construction of fusion power plants, and which will lead to innovative and exceptional solutions to our most enduring medical, biological, and environmental problems. In 2003, it cost tens to hundreds of dollars per million floating point operations per second for the requisite computational facilities, and there were very few institutions in this arena. For instance, the top-rated supercomputer at that time, at the beginning of 2003, was a 35 teraflops Earth simulator at Yokohama, Japan, and was reported to have cost over $250 million, or over $250 per megaflops. Since the 1980s, scientists like Eugene Brooks at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and Thomas Sterling of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory were advocates for the potential extraordinary Powell economies in large-scale parallel computer architectures. Eugene Brooks gave substance to the refrain, no one will survive the attack of the killer macros. In reference to the idea that the future of high-performance computing was dependent upon utilizing architectures aligned with and leveraging the cost-performance gains being realized in processor technology and consistent with Moore's law. Thomas Sterling was one of the developers of the Beowulf model for high-performance computer systems. Beowulfs were parallel systems built with commodity hardware and open-source software. The promise of this model was to deliver a price-performance ratio that put high-performance computing into the hands of individual researchers and into small laboratories, and that opened this alternative to a wide array of applications. Prior to 2003, the top 100 high-performance computer systems ranked according to the measured performance of the largest problem run on each system. All had performance capability greater than one teraflop. Assuming the upper budgetary bounds of most laboratories or academic departments for computing and network facilities, being anywhere from a few hundred thousands of dollars to a few millions of dollars, the goal of broad deployment of terascale computing facilities suggested a maximum cost per megaflops had to be well under a dollar. Until 2003, scant evidence existed that this less than $1 per megaflop standard, the terascale class computer systems would be realized in the near term. The first hint of a breakthrough occurred in our community in the spring of 2003. The National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign announced that they had successfully used the Emotion Engine graphics coprocessors in a parallel assembly of 70 Sony PlayStation devices, giving the assembly a theoretical peak performance capability of nearly 1/2 trillion floating point operations per second. The NCSA project set the stage for November 2003 supercomputing conference in Phoenix, Arizona. For the first time, multiple higher education institutions placed multi-teraflop supercomputers in the top five on that list. I was especially proud that according to one spokesman for the top 500 list, the third system ever to exceed the 10 teraflops mark was Virginia Tech's System 10 cluster measured at 10.28 teraflops. Another university system in the top five was at NCSA, University of Illinois. In the spring, in that previous spring of 2003, Virginia Tech quietly assembled a project team from the College of Engineering, the Computer Science Department, and the Information Technology Organization to build a high-performance computer system, later named System 10. Most remarkably, the total cost of that computer and communications hardware configuration was $5.2 million for a cost-to-peak performance measure of 30 cents per megaflops. Just as astounding, under university direction, a half a dozen new and emerging hardware technologies were assembled and critical software components developed in just over 90 days, and it all worked. Notable problems still need to be solved to increase the utility of large-scale parallel computer systems. However, with ever-increasing economies of scale and scope, we have compelling evidence that a broad set of the nation's scholars and researchers will be able to participate in supercomputing independent data assembly and analysis, simulations and computations required to solve our world's most fundamental science and engineering problems. With these demonstrated new economies within this decade, our national cyber infrastructure will include thousands of interconnected high-performance systems accessible to the majority of higher education-based research community. Such accomplishments represent our progress in distributed communications infrastructure and in high-performance computing that have profound implications for academia, for our nation, and for the world. The world has too many complex and serious problems Timely solutions require broad collaborations, tap in every possible contributor, and open frictionless access to the most powerful computation and data assembly facilities. And these next few words are really a theme we've been pounding on for almost 20 years at Virginia Tech. The dominant perspective of today's internet is of a huge consumer network, but its greatest potential will be in its transformation to a global producer network. Higher education is the appropriate institution to lead this transformation through the perspective that every member of our community is a potential producer and contributor of research and scholarship in this new world, and by building the infrastructure and more importantly, the literacy that underpins it. Now I want to turn to what I have to admit were the darkest days of my life. On April 16, 2007, a student at Virginia Tech shot and killed 32 faculty and students before killing himself in an academic building on campus. Many more were wounded. I expect that Virginia Tech in some ways will always be dealing with the aftermath of that tragedy. The first lesson for me was that we live in an increasingly dangerous world. Since the end of the Cold War, there has been a dramatic decrease in state-on-state wars, but a marked rise in violence by stateless groups. A single individual or a committed small group leveraging readily available advanced technologies and increasingly deadly weapons can at relatively low cost research, organize, acquire critical components, and execute a complex plan with horrible consequences unimaginable in human history. A second lesson, relevant to virtually every human-initiated act of violence, are the following stark facts. First, the burden for preventing or mitigating the vast majority of these incidents has been and will be on poorly financed and supported local communities, security, and first responder personnel and institutions. Second, while new advances in information technology, communications, and computing have resulted in profound changes in the way we live and work and radically altered virtually every facet of human inquiry, it has hardly touched how communities prepare for, prevent, respond to, and mitigate acts of violence. A significant disconnect exists between information technology practitioners and public safety principles at the local community level. Except in the case of a few major cities, at all levels of government, there is no culture of experimentation with emerging new technologies or capabilities or of innovation in frontline public safety institutions. I led the post-tragedy internal review of how campus and regional and national technology infrastructure was leveraged and how it performed related to the shooting tragedy at Virginia Tech on April 16, 2007. We established 14 project teams involving over 80 individuals to complete specific data gathering and analysis assignments. The teams examined the effectiveness of systems and personnel and identified challenges taken into account, recorded performance measurement, comments from interviewed emergency responders and university community members, and observations and records of the university communications providers. We developed over 120 recommendations specific to particular functional areas which presented opportunities for improvement. Virtually all of these recommendations address issues or circumstances that would have made the hours, day, and days following the April 16th event less chaotic. The poignant realization for me as an IT professional was that few of our findings would have been relevant to early detection or mitigation of the events of April 16th. Exploring and exploiting technology innovations and leveraging massive collaboration to address this aspect of global as well as community security is fertile ground for innovation. Although this should not be a high priority or main thrust our university community should be engaged in this space. A few of you in this room know that there is a danger of a shift in equilibrium against individual liberties anytime the political pressure for public security increases. There is a compelling need to create new, safe, and secure environments that reduce fear through enhanced security while preserving individual liberties. Probably the only community that I trust to find and to advocate the right balance between public and individual interests is the higher education community. Back to my first days as a freshman at Virginia Tech in 1963, First Lieutenant Jenkins talked about two values, two concepts I have never forgotten. The first is Virginia Tech's motto, a prosium, meaning that I may serve. We learn, we prepare ourselves, we create good habits, and we practice good values so that we may serve our families and our global community. The second is courage. Jenkins even quoted Aristotle, courage is the most important human virtue, for it enables all the others. He talked about all those that came before us at Virginia Tech that demonstrated extraordinary courage and the commitment of that idea that I may serve. Today, I'm also remembering the greatest demonstration of these values by the Virginia Tech community. Our students grew up fast on April 16th of 2007. They led the spontaneous celebration of the 32 lives taken on that tragic day. They refused to accept the proposition that evil would dominate that story. Instead, the students at Virginia Tech in 2007 focused the light of those extraordinary people, each with extraordinary compassion. They focused the light on these extraordinary people, each with extraordinary compassion and goodness. Because of them, the world read about our incredible brothers and sisters that lost their lives that day. And for that, I will always be grateful. In closing, I want to close with an example of community leadership that has nothing to do with information technology. In Virginia, we've experienced the rise of political extremism that seems scornful of basic social values most of us share. A few years ago, our state government appointed board, under the influence of a misguided and out of control state attorney general. I wonder whether he's watching this program today on the internet. But under the influence of this attorney general, repealed the university's anti-discrimination policy. Several employees in our information technology organization expressed great concern for what this might mean to their future at Virginia Tech. The following is my response to one of those colleagues. You expressed the hope that the governor and board of visitors would be made aware of and understand your concerns about your future at Virginia Tech in the context of Monday's board resolution related to discrimination and affirmative action. I was very disappointed that such a significant policy statement was passed without the administration having prior warning and without careful study and consideration of potential broad impacts. I was not present for the discussion in the Board of Visitors executive session and can only surmise some of the considerations and intent of the board. However, I have several personal conclusions to share. You live in a university community with broad shared values and with traditions of inclusiveness and fairness that far outweigh the actions of any board, any politician, any legislative body. This action by the board does not change my values, the values of our president, executive vice president, or provost, or the values of your friends and colleagues. This action in no way threatens your job or your future at Virginia Tech. It certainly did not, quote, make it legal to fire, quote, you or to, quote, take other disciplinary actions against you because of your sexual orientation. Federal and state law has not changed with respect to this, neither has your university community's values. At the time I wrote this, I believed but was not certain that the university community pressure would force the board to reinstate our anti-discrimination policies. This happened a few days later. after an extraordinary demonstration of support by a university community. I remember just being in awe about our president sitting right next to the chairman of the Board of Visitors, each putting their position on the table, the president calling for the reinstatement of the anti-discrimination policies, and the board chair arguing the other way, with the understanding that the president didn't know he had the votes for this to be overturned, and also understood that if the vote was lost in this, there was a very good chance that the board would immediately turn around and fire the president. Didn't make any difference. This issue was bigger than any of that. This happened a few days later after an extraordinary demonstration of support by a university community. I've always enjoyed and considered myself lucky to have chosen the information technology profession for my life's career. But this intense and united response by the people at Virginia Tech reminded me that I'm also blessed to be part of the higher education universe with its core values. This sum of the actions of faculty, staff, students, alumni, and a few courageous board members at the University of Virginia again succeeded in turning back a politically misguided board. Once again, they made me, and I suspect most of you, proud to be a member of the nation's higher education community. This is who we serve, and that makes our jobs as information technology professionals so special. Thank you.
Thank you, Irv, for your comments and your thoughts and your leadership. We have a few minutes for questions, and if you would like to ask a question or share a thought, there's some microphones at the front of the room here. If you are a part of our online audience, there's a chat room window on the right-hand side of your player. Please use that to ask your questions. So it's a little bright up here at the font, but look out there, step forward to a microphone with a question. Okay, well, seeing none, we'll be here at the front of the room. Thank you so much for your participation, and Herb, thank you so much for your